put it in a 10-foot dish on the roof of Building 1. Then that radiometer is used for several years to look at the sun and moon. And numerous lunar eclipses were observed, and the sun was observed fairly extensively, and none of this was ever published.
What was the reason for the lack of publishing? It just wasn't in their tradition, or?
Probably partly that. And probably partly that we were just expecting too much, and we didn't publish just routine results, which probably should have been done, but wasn't. In other words, nothing very exciting or remarkable happened, or nothing happened that we could interpret in an exciting or remarkable way.
I see.
So it just didn't ever get published. But part of it was probably just habit, too. Well, anyway, and somewhere along about there, the sun was being looked at in an attempt to measure atmospheric absorption at 3 centimeters. And during the measurement, a flare occurred, a fairly nice burst, 3 centimeters, which was the first burst observed at wavelengths that short. That was published.
This is what year now?
I think it was about 49, somewhere around there.
Where was that published?
Physical Review Letters.
By whom, if I may?
The first author was a guy named Shulkin.
S-C-H?
S-C-H-U-L-K-I-N. Well, anyway, somewhere throughout this whole period, too, Hagen and Haddock, and I'm not sure which one really got the idea first, started pushing the 50-foot dish. And as I remember, one of the ideas for building the dish, or at least one of the justifications for building it, was for a moon radar. And it got built somewhere along 49. I think it was erected in about 50. But it didn't really get started to be used for any significant radio astronomy for 2 or 3 years later. So in that intervening period, we'll skip the 50-foot dish then for a couple of years.
What was the reason for this delay? No suitable receivers? Or?
I'm not quite sure. Part of it certainly was because we were doing these other things that I was going to skip back to. And part of it was that it went through quite a long test and alignment period. And then it went through quite a long period where Hagen was trying to use it at 8 millimeters, which was all unsuccessful for a number of reasons, some of which maybe we'd better not mention.
Was the surface partly to blame, or is it that good?
I think the surface was undoubtedly partly to blame. And, what Haddock and Schlonecker and I privately concluded later was that we didn't think they knew where they were pointing well enough.
Yeah, okay.
But they did, in fact, point at the sun and get some results on the sun.
But this was this is a form of 16-inch gun mount, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Which was
not 16-inch. It was a twin 5-inch.
Twin 5-inch.
Anti-aircraft gun mount.
I see.
2 5-inch guns on one mount.
And what was the supposed pointing accuracy? What were the specs? I guess it must have met specs, or it wouldn't have been accepted.
No, I don't think that's right at all.
That's a rash assumption.
It wasn't a matter of accepting it. Again, I wasn't in on any of this, so I don't know true facts. But I assume the reason for putting it on a gun mount in the first place was to save money and not have to build a mount.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the aiming specs were for the gun mount as a gun mount, but I suppose they're pretty good. I don't happen to know what they were. But of course, the way it was hooked up to point the dish was considerably different from that. And that's, we can get into a little later.
But that was always sort of the limitation, wasn't it, for that dish? What's the point?
Yeah, sure. Where?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, in the years, well, there were three major eclipse expeditions. To Attu in 1950, and to Khartoum in 1952, and to Oskarshamn, Sweden in 1954. And these were major efforts for a group of like four people. And they certainly kept myself and to a large extent Haddock and to quite a large extent Hagen and to quite a large extent a couple of other people pretty well occupied full time just getting ready for these things. I mean, the logistics were terrible going to places like that. You had to carry everything.
Now, what was the purpose of these?
Well, the purpose was to try to get the radio brightness distribution on the sun and the real specific thing you can point to is to prove limb brightening. But the real underlying thing, of course, was to test out or help develop models of the chromosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Hagen did for his thesis, was these chromospheric models. And of course he had a very strong drive to get the experimental data to either confirm or test out or whatever you want to call it.
Which school was this?
Georgetown. And anyway, those, there were only, well, I don't remember now, there were different people brought in on different parts of things and stuff, but through that whole period there were only like two or three or four people working on radio astronomy full time. There was some effort by some other people on a limited part-time component basis, but it was mainly just that kind of group, so these eclipse efforts were a full-time job.
So that's maybe why the 50-foot languished a little bit.
That's one of the reasons. Well, anyway, somewhere in that period also, the hydrogen line was picked up. And Hagen right away got interested in that, and he ordered a hydrogen line receiver from Yuen. And I don't remember dates.
You say ordered now, is this, Yuen already have his company, or?
Well, I guess so. I'm not quite sure about that. That's about the time the company came into being. But whether he had his company or not, he
got it.
Sold
right.
Two or three radiometers. And I don't remember again the date this thing arrived, but it was somewhere probably around 52 or 53. But at that time, Hagen brought McLean in to get that hydrogen line system going. McLean had zero interest in radio astronomy. And in fact, he didn't even want to do it. He didn't want to do this, but Hagen had him do it. And so really the first thing of any significance that happened with the 50-foot was that Haddock and Schlenecker and I finally got Hagen to let us put a radiometer in it. This was a 9-centimeter radiometer. He let us have a week.
What was it doing otherwise?
Nothing. These sort of things.
I mean, just a week off your what you were doing otherwise.
He let us have a week on the antenna. I think it was a week. Might have been 2 weeks.
But I'm just wondering why he was so stingy, because he felt you should be working on other things?
Well, I was just assuming it's not on tape, but he didn't want anybody else to use it.
I see.
It was a competition thing. And, I mean, that's my opinion. And I think it's right. But,
so you got a week on the antenna.
We got a week on the antenna, and we first thing we looked for was H2 regions, and we found 15 of them or something. And also looked at the then known strong radio sources, things like CASA and CygnusA and so forth at this wavelength. previous measurements, I think the shortest wavelength had been, on some of those sources like CASA, possibly 20 centimeters. I'm not sure of that even. It might have been a much lower frequency, I can't remember. But certainly nobody had found the H2 regions. Well, anyway, so after that week or two, whatever it was, the 21 centimeter continuum radiometer was put in, and they looked at all these same sources, 21 centimeters, and a different group now. This was McLean and Hagen. And also the strong radio sources. And they found some additional H2 regions. So cool. And then again, I guess at about that same time, without looking up dates, I don't know, they got the line system working.
Well, before we go on to the line system, can I just clarify? First of all, had these H2 regions been detected at lower frequencies before?
No.
So that was the first there. And what was the impetus to look at H2 regions? Was this part of these feasibility things that Haddock was doing?
Oh, I suppose so. It was just an obvious thing to look at short wavelengths. It was known that they should be thermal sources.
Yeah, at 10,000 degrees, roughly. And so I guess also that when you combine the 9 and the 21 centimeter observations, this also helped prove they were thermal. Or did you
They weren't actually combined, but yes, taking the two results separately and looking at them is,
yeah,
is true. But anyway, so as far as I can remember, right at the same time the line system was got working. And about the first thing that happened was they saw the absorption in front of, I guess, CASA. I don't remember what the first source was.
Let me ask one other question. The H2 region stuff was published.
Yes.
In FJ?
There were two papers. The first one was in Astrophysical Journal, I think. The second one was in Nature. On the 9 centimeter. And the 21 centimeter was also published somewhere. I don't remember where.
And this is in the era of 53 or so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 54.
So the line observations, that was didn't involve you, though. That was Hagen.
No, that was Hagen and McLean originally.
McLean and Lilly was in there somehow, or is that a little later?
No, Hagen and McLean actually found the absorption. And along about that time, Lilly came. And then some of the remainder of the work was done by Hagen, Lilly, and McLean.
I see.
But there's a lot of confusion about the absorption to start out with, and let me see if I can remember what the confusion was. In other words, it took them a long time to straighten out that this was absorption by neutral hydrogen in front of the source. It seems odd that they would have thought anything else, but I believe they had some other idea, and I can't even imagine at the moment what the other idea could be, but...
Someone has told me, I don't know if it was you or not, that they were confused that they thought the source was blocking the hydrogen, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. There was something like that, but as I say, it's kind of hard to imagine.
I haven't gone back, but they say if you read the first paper by Hagen and McLean, you can ferret out that confusion. And then when Lilly came along, they had the equation of radiative transfer, and it's properly worked out.
Yeah, but I think there's some confusion as to who straightened it out. It may have been Lilly, I don't remember. But he was awfully confused about it, too. I can remember that for sure. He wasn't at all clear on it.
This is basically because they were not spectroscopists, I suppose.
Lilly was as much a radio spectroscopist as there was then. He had just come out of Harvard.
I guess that's true, too.
That was one of the two or three places in the world that was doing that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And he did his thesis on it. I don't know. As I say, at the present time, I can't...
I'll have to ask Lilly about that one.
At the present time, I can't imagine what the confusion was or why, but there was an awful lot of confusion. And there was an awful lot of confusion about how to interpret the measurements and what they meant. And remember an awful lot of questions. But, well, anyway, there was another eclipse in there, too, 54 one, you see. And actually, while we were on the 54 eclipse, Haddock put a 3-centimeter radiometer in the 50-foot and didn't get any results at all. Again, I have never been clear why. I don't know what they were doing wrong. They were doing something wrong.
These eclipses were at what frequency now?
Well, various frequencies. The Attu eclipse, we had 8 millimeters, 3 centimeters, 10 centimeters.
Oh, that's
And Reber was along at 61 centimeters or something like that.
And this was using a just a 10-foot dish or something?
No, there were special equipments that were built. Actually, for the Attu eclipse, that's not the right picture. I can show you the pictures if you're interested, but maybe you want to turn your tape off.
Yeah, well, let's do it afterwards.
All right. But they were equipments that were built specially for the eclipse, and as you can see, that one was built. That was one of two that were built after the Attu eclipse, and they were used at Khartoum in Sweden. And I built that one 100% from scratch, even the waveguide components. That was the 9-centimeter one. And I built the trailer mounting and everything for the 8-millimeter one. And then Gibson and Hagen built the receiver for 8 millimeters. And for both the, not for Attu, but for both the Khartoum and Sweden eclipse trips, they had a big cylindrical paraboloid for the 8-millimeter measurement, which had a fan beam, narrow in one dimension and more broad in the other dimension. And the narrow dimension was lined up with the path of the moon, so they could get more of a strip scan and eliminate some of the ambiguity from the sector business.
Right. Did this confirm the limb brightening?
Yeah, it did as much as you can confirm it from that kind of measurement. The trouble is that you don't get a singular result from a single measurement. You would have to have more than one station. You'd have to have a station on the path of totality and then one or two, preferably, on either side in order to eliminate the redundancies. So the solutions made on the assumption, say, of a circular symmetry did give sharp, bright rings. And we tried more sophisticated models on the 9-centimeter, at least, of more oval-type brightness distributions. And they then gave bright edges, at least in the equatorial plane.
So I guess the best reference for this would be Hagen's thesis.
No, I don't think so, because that was, again, I don't remember dates, but I'm sure that thesis came before some of these later eclipses.
Oh, I see.
Just to summarize the results of the eclipse measurements, the first one off Brazil was pretty much unsuccessful. They had the antenna on the mast of a destroyer which was bobbing in the sea, and they had a hard time keeping it pointed at the sun. Now, the Attu eclipse, the equipment all worked, but a typhoon arrived the day before the eclipse, and the whole day of the eclipse there was a typhoon. We took data anyway in the typhoon, but obviously it wasn't first class.
Even during the typhoon, was the eclipse.
That's right. We got pictures showing us all around, standing out there taking data.
Now, where is
that? We did get eclipse curves, but they were ragged.
Yeah. Where is that too?
That's the farthest out of the Aleutian Islands. It's about 500 miles from Siberia.
So that must have been rather discouraging to go all that way for a typhoon, but anyway.
And the Khartoum eclipse, the equipment worked, and the weather was beautiful, but the sun didn't cooperate. There were large active regions on both limbs, which, of course, the limbs were the critical points in the eclipse curve. So, in order to get, of course, you could get information on bright regions, but to get the kind of information that was being looked for in the quiet sun, those had to be subtracted out, and of course, that was, well, it's one of these things that's not possible to do, really. And so, in Sweden, the equipment worked, and the weather was reasonably good. There was no rain or anything. There were some clouds. They didn't seem to bother the measurements very much. And the sun cooperated perfectly. Starting a month and a half before the eclipse day, there was absolutely no solar activity, and that extended to several weeks after the eclipse. So it's probably one of the quietest periods the sun has ever undergone. And that was excellent data, and the results of that experiment were limited entirely by the ability to reduce that kind of data. You could do what you could do with it.
Right.
And
so where was this published, this eclipse data?
Well, different places. I think the main publications are in that Jodrell Bank Symposium volume.
55 one, yeah. So actually the only optical eclipse, I mean, that you've seen was Sudan, was it? Khartoum.
The only one that was visible on
it. Right.
Visible, yeah, and I didn't go to Khartoum.
Oh, so you've never seen one, even though you've
been... The only one I've seen is the one last year in Virginia Beach.
You've been to all these eclipses, and it's the only one that you've seen.
Yeah. But anyway, so that's about the story on the eclipses.
So back to the 21 centimeter line, we talked about the first, and then Lilly came along, and they did some more further work.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess there's...
Now that's all pretty well published, I think. And that work began with the discovery of absorption, and they did some more things with it, and it ended with the Cygnus A redshift, which totally discouraged McLean and, I guess, sort of discouraged Lilly.
I'm not sure I'm familiar with this.
Well, this was an experiment they did. You know, one of the vexing problems in radio astronomy has been that you have to rely on optical redshifts. So one of the things that people have always been trying to do, ever since you had lines anyway, is measure redshifts in the radio region.
Right.
And one of the most intriguing objects around in the 50s was Cygnus A, which Bott and Minkowski claimed were colliding galaxies at that time and so forth. And they claimed these colliding galaxies were what was then considered to be a tremendous distance, which I don't remember. But it was, well, I don't remember, but you can look it up.
Yeah.
At that time, that was the greatest distance of anything. Now it's nothing but. So it would be obviously a great thing to find a redshifted hydrogen line, which would confirm the optical redshift, help confirm the identification and so forth. And they did an experiment in which they found a redshifted line in the proper place. But then, pretty quick, some of these other people, like Rod Davies, tried the same experiment, got negative results. So then Lilly McLean felt compelled to do another experiment and confirm it. And their second experiment got negative results too. So it's one of those things.
Did they ever publish their positive thing?
Yes, unfortunately.
Where was that?
I don't know, it was in the file, Audrey.
One of the astronomical journals, then?
Yeah, it's one of those unfortunate things where it not only was announced and published, but a lot of fuss was made over it, and all of these
press releases.
Famous astronomers got all excited about it and gave it a lot of lip service, like Bott and so forth. And,
was this an emission feature they had?
Absorption.
Absorption, I see. Yeah, a few thousand kilometers per second to the redshift.
I don't remember what the redshift was. It was where it was supposed to be from the optical. Well, anyway, that bombed out. And nothing much after that was done on hydrogen on here.
Did they ever publish a refutation of...
I don't think so.
Did Davies publish his?
Yes. I think it was Davies.
Yeah.
And maybe other people did it too then, I can't remember.
Let me ask you a question about the 50-foot while I think of it. That was the largest dish used for radio astronomy when it was erected, right?
Yeah.
What had been...
I think it was the largest steerable paraboloid, but in any case, it was certainly the largest steerable paraboloid usable at short wavelengths for many years.
And do you know what, which was the largest when it was built?
No, I don't, but it may have been. Probably was.
No. I was thinking, which did it displace from being the largest in the world?
Yeah, I don't know. But during that period, there weren't really any large dishes.
Well, I guess the 60-footer at Agassiz. But that wasn't usable at such short wavelengths, though, was it?
No, and they didn't have it then.
Yeah, right, they didn't get that till 56.
They had a 30-foot or something.
28, I think it was. Something like that.
The 60-foot, I don't think they got until about 1955 or 56.
Right.
Over there.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they had this 28-foot, which I think essentially Heeshan and Lilly erected and put together. And maybe there were others, too. That group of graduate students.
Right. I'm a little bit puzzled why there weren't other astronomers trying to get to the 50-foot and so forth, if it wasn't being used much. Or hadn't this tradition of outside astronomers working in NRL been set up?
No, there certainly was no tradition of outside people working in NRL. There still isn't really a tradition of it, but...
Well, I think there is, isn't there? I mean,
well, there has been radio astronomy and maybe a few other places.
Well, I mean radio astronomy I'm talking about, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and radio astronomy.
But I guess that didn't really begin until the Townes Maser and all that. That's what started that off. Well, before the Townes Maser, I guess Venus comes before that, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing I wanted to mention, though, that during all this period, too, an awful lot of work was devoted to... radiometer development, technique development, and I think personally that is what really paid off in the end. I mean, for a number of years nothing much came of it, but then that's what made it possible to do the measurements that were done later in the 50-foot. And for example, development of such things as ferrite switches and methods for using gas tubes for calibration, and absolute calibration of gas tubes. That was all done here.
Well, now, in fact, you were responsible, you personally were the one that worked in the ferrite switch, were you not?
Yeah. And some of the gas tube work, and Cease and Corbett did some of the gas tube work, particularly the absolute calibrations. They, in fact, did calibrations for the Bureau of Standards, as I remember.
And what was the ferrite switch a new concept, or was it something that you adapted from some other field?
No, it was adapted. It was a new concept, but not new here. And I can't remember for sure where the concept first came into being, but I think it was in Holland that the ferrite materials were developed. And then I'm not, again, absolutely sure, but I'm fairly sure that the concept of the isolator and circulator using the ferrite components in waveguide was initially proposed and demonstrated by a guy named Hogan at Bell Lab. And he published a paper in Bell System Technical Journal describing the isolator and circulator, which I saw and thought it was immediately obvious that this should be used in radiometers. As you say, principally for this reason, that up until then, the toughest problem was calibration. That the schemes for calibration were using hot loads and that sort of thing.
Mm.
Which the usual procedure was to unbolt the feed and bolt on a hot load. Well, not only did that take a long time and introduce errors, but there was a big systematic error in this whole procedure because the impedance of the source was not the same as the impedance of the horn, or when you had to put two sources, like a hot load and an ambient load, to get the calibration spread.